It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold in for Rob Parrott. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at the latest in national politics. This week, how has Scott Walker positioned himself among other candidates by releasing a policy to repeal and replace Obamacare?
But first, Krivitz High School in Marinette County has announced that it will begin a system of random drug testing of its students this fall.
It follows in the footsteps of several other Wisconsin schools, including nearby Kimberly, which has been testing since 2002.
Random drug tests were limited to school athletes before a 2002 U.S. Supreme Court ruling that expanded schools' authority. Since that time, though, any middle or high school students who participate in school sports or extracurricular activities can be tested.
Joining us to talk about the goals of Krivitz High School's new policy is Jeff Dorschner. He's the athletic director of Krivitz High School and has been involved in the decision to implement drug testing. Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Well, why don't we start off with why you decided this was the thing to do? What were the things that drove you to move in this direction?
This is my third year now as athletic director here in the district. I've noticed a growing drug problem in Marinette County, and I've noticed an increasing drug problem going on in the high school. I also teach social studies full-time here for the last 7 years. And as far as dealing with code violations, we've had a number of code violations in just my two short years of being athletic director involving drug use. And so I collaborate with our superintendent and our high school principal. They encouraged me to move forward and pitch to our school board an idea of bringing something along the lines of a randomized drug testing policy. It started really probably in March, and after a few months of research and whatnot, and being able to go out and get funding for this, I was able to make a pitch to the board in June to pass a policy like this, and it passed unanimously. So we're going to go ahead with the 2015-16 school year on RAM.
You mentioned the funding for it, and that's one of the first things people think about is that it would cost money. But it sounds like you've figured out a way to pay for it without using school funding, right?
Yeah, the funding for this program will not cost a taxpayer in our district one penny. Bay Area Medical Center, which is the hospital out of Marinette, who also provides athletic training services for our sports programs here, free of charge, has graciously donated their funds to support a program like this. We only have 200 kids in our high school, so we're looking at doing this twice a month, and doing five tests basically twice a month. So it amounts to, and just during the school year, that just amounts to 90 tests. So it's not a ton of funding on their end.
That's 90 tests. So about half of the kids will be tested then.
Well, it kind of depends. It's a truly randomized selection process. What we're going to be doing is we're going to be giving Bay Area Medical a list of our student ID numbers that have no names attached to them. Mm-hmm. They are going to run that through their computerized program, and they're going to spit out five student ID numbers back to us, and it's going to get sent to me. And so there is a possibility that students can get tested three times, four times in a year. It could be a possibility that students don't get tested until they're juniors or seniors if they started as freshmen. So it truly is a randomized process.
So who will be included in those tests?
We're going to include anyone that participates in the extracurricular activities, that's interscholastic sports, cheer and dance, and then we have what we call our group two and three activities. Examples of that would be like National Honor Society, Student Council, pep band, things along those natures, and anybody that applies for a parking permit. We don't charge anybody a parking pass, but we do require them to have a permit hanging in their window. And the reason why we can only test extracurricular participants and people that apply for a parking pass is that basically is the furthest our arm can extend on testing our students.
So how many kids do you think this will include then? That's probably most kids, right?
My guess it'll be most of the school population will be in that pool to begin with anyway.
And what about students who wouldn't fall into that? I guess they just wouldn't be tested.
They will not be put into the pool, no.
Now, you talked about the increase in drug issues at your high school and that there was one code violation, which I'm guessing would be a student-athlete or somebody like that.
And we had numerous code violations, yes.
Yeah, and that is that, when you say code violation, do you mean somebody who was using drugs or caught using drugs in some way or another? What is it?
Caught using drugs while they were participating in extracurriculars.
Oh, wow. And what kind of drugs are we talking about here? Because I'm guessing that the growth in drug use in your county is what kind of drugs are those? Is it heroin? And
we had a pretty high spike in the use of heroin. Talking with local police force as well, aside of just marijuana, it's the abusing of prescription medications as well. That's been a big concern for them. Personally, here we haven't dealt with anything like that yet, but this isn't a program designed to see how many we can catch. It's just basically it's designed to deter students from using drugs, and it, more so than deterring them from using drugs, when it comes down to peer pressure, if they really enjoy playing their sports or doing their activities outside the classroom, you know, that'll give them an excuse with peer pressure if they want to go down that road that, you know, they don't want to.
I would guess that some of the thinking behind this is they're representing the school, so having people using drugs who represent the school in some way or another is probably not a good thing.
Right. We always will hold our kids who do represent our school in those arenas to a higher standard.
Now, Kimberly High School has been doing drug testing in kind of the same way since 2002. Did you talk to them as you were thinking through this? Or
yeah, I consulted with Kimberly's athletic director, Ryan McGinnis, as well as DePere's athletic director, Jeff Bizek. And, you know, they gave me access to, well, you can get it online as well, but I took a look at their policies and tried to kind of formulate one that would fit our district. And they were really helpful in the whole process on giving advice. And they said they've had no issues as far as any type of backlashing going on and people refusing to take the test or anything like that. It's a way of life in those schools, and they want to keep their students clean and their schools clean of any type of drug use, at least try to anyway.
No, not everybody supports the policies. There was a report that came out from the American Academy of Pediatrics that says there's not sufficient proof that this is a way to discourage drug use, particularly if it's not used in conjunction with other prevention and intervention strategies. So are you including some other things along with this, or is this the main part of your drug prevention strategy at your school?
Well, we are. And there was, when this first got reported, it was reported that we are requiring students to attend counseling. We're not requiring students to attend counseling. But I think the biggest thing, you know, more so, more importantly than just sitting a contest or two because of drug use, is getting the parents involved and getting the problem out on the table, and making them aware of the situation. On top of that, you know, offering services. You know, our school counselor has access to services that the county puts forth for. You know, anybody that may be going down that road of addiction and offering that help. I think it's a matter of, if the way we see it as a district, if we can just turn around, you know, one or two kids from going down that path, this program is well worth it.
Now, I guess it could be asked, though. I mean, there could be some kids who opt out of school activities and decide to not drive to school anymore so they can avoid this. So how do you deal with those kids? Because it seems like what could happen with something like this is you wind up having some kids who may have some exposure to drugs deciding to go in the direction of drugs rather than being engaged in school and things like that. How could you address, or have you thought about addressing that in any way?
Well, yeah, before we implement this program, we did do a survey with the community. And there was about 75 to 80% of people were strongly in support of something like this. And while there may be a minority of kids who feel that using drugs is more important, we live in a rural community. If they don't want to park their cars here, that's going to be a little bit of a walk for them. And it gets a little cold up here in northern Wisconsin. So if they really want to get around those steps and keep doing what they're doing, and you know, that's their own individual choice. I mean, as a public high school, we cannot test everybody, but we, in essence, when you go off the main extreme of school policy and you do something like this, and this is really nothing new. 18% of high schools nationwide have some type of drug testing program in their policies already. So that's about one out of every five high schools across the country have this already. So it's really nothing that's brand new. We didn't invent any wheel here.
So as you implement the program, how will you decide if it's a success or a failure?
Well, we're going to take statistics for sure and see how this is panned out. I mean, it doesn't cost our district anything, which is a big thing. If this was a big cost, you know, I can see the cause for concern if we're not turning kids away. But from what I've heard already, and I help coach football up here, from what I heard through the grapevine with kids and kids speak, it's a small school. It's the way it goes. There have been a couple students already that have decided to go down a better path because we've implemented something like this.
Now, one final question is it doesn't cover alcohol, these tests, right?
No, speaking with Bay Area Medical and the type of drug test that we decided that we were going to use, alcohol was not one of them for a couple of reasons. One, it doesn't stay in your system that long. And if alcohol is in your system, if we suspect alcohol, and this has always kind of been the case, too, with in our school, if we suspect that a student is abusing alcohol and we have suspicion, we can call in the police and have a breathalyzer done at school.
Okay.
That's one of the reasons why we didn't have that part of the test, or alcohol part of the test.
Well, Jeff, thanks so much for talking to us today.
All right. Well, thank you for having us.
That was Jeff Dorschner. He's the athletic director for Krivitz High School in Marinette County, Wisconsin, where they're set to begin random drug testing of high school students.
Governor Walker released his plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act yesterday as part of his presidential campaign, and he slipped in the polls. As he's done that, can a focus on health policy bring the attention back? Right now, it's our weekly look at the latest in national politics.
Also this week, another Democrat, Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey, has come out against the nuclear deal with Iran as deadline closes in for a vote in Congress. And as Bernie Sanders continues to rally thousands around the country, some Clinton allies are worried that her campaign is floundering.
Joining us now is Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, how does Governor Walker's release of this health care plan position him now among his fellow Republican candidates?
You know, Scott Walker came into this campaign as a candidate with a lot of promise. Somebody who had a conservative record, had won in a blue state three times in 4 years, and the result of this campaign has been anything but great for him. He's fallen in the polls in Iowa, as you alluded to, and he's somebody who needs to get back on track. And one of the reasons that he's fallen is there doesn't seem to be anything there. You know, you have this great record, but then you come out on the campaign trail, and it's a lot of blah. It sort of reminds me of, in some ways, of John Glenn in 84 for the Democrats, who had this great resume, and then he just started talking, and everyone went, what's going on here? So Walker is trying to adjust to the realities on the ground, and one of the knocks against him being that he really didn't have much of, you know, a policy and was able to articulate that. Here he comes as the first person, health care, a big deal in the Republican primary, very anti-Obamacare audience that you're dealing with. So this is something where he's going to try and get back on track. Will it work or not? We can't be sure. But we do know that there are already some complaints from some Republicans about this plan, from Rick Perry's campaign and from Bobby Jindal's campaign. But whether or not actual Republican voters are going to see this as a bad thing or a good thing, we don't know. But you know what? It can't get any worse for him at this point as he's falling, so it can only get better.
There's a lot of hot-button issues out there right now for the debate. Why did Governor Walker choose health care, do you think?
I think he probably chose health care because, number one, it's a domestic issue that, you know, Walker can speak to. It's not foreign policy. It's somewhat more in his wheelhouse. It's also one in which you can really put a real prescription for what you're going to do. You know, when it comes to the economy, you could say that, oh, we're going to go X and X percentage growth. But it's very difficult for a president to actually control the state of the economy. Foreign policy, it's also very difficult. There's a lot of, you know, moving parts in it. While health care is something where you have one real issue where you can really concentrate on, it's Obamacare. That's what the Republican audience wants to hear about. And Walker or any other Republican come out with one plan, sort of a one-size-fits-all.
Is this a sign that the Affordable Care Act and healthcare in general are going to be big in the 2016 presidential election, or is this just sort of the first thing out of the gate right now?
I think healthcare is going to be big, at least on the Republican side. You know, if you look at the polls, what are the most important issues? Obviously, the economy is number one. Foreign policy, terrorism is number two. But healthcare is actually number three. It tends to rank ahead of where immigration is for most Republican voters, which is very interesting. You wouldn't necessarily expect that. But healthcare is a very important issue to Republican primary voters. So it's not really much of a surprise to me that that's going to be, you know, the issue that Walker wants to go out on and be strong on. It's an issue that Republican voters care about. And if you can be the candidate of, you know, the anti-Obamacare, be the anti-Obamacare candidate, it's a very, very good position to be in a Republican primary.
We're talking to Harry Enten right now, senior political writer and analyst for 538. We're getting the latest from the campaign trail in national politics. Iowa State Fair just happened. We've had a lot of visuals, pictures, videos, candidates eating things like pork chops on a stick. So what's the significance of the Iowa State Fair? Why does it matter, or does it matter?
Well, I'll tell you, there are not very many kosher people there, that's for sure. But I would say that this is just a type of thing that's kind of fun for the candidates to come out. They get their name out. They get some good press in Iowa, obviously, the Iowa caucus being the first contest in the primary season. Whether anyone actually remembers what happened this past weekend or this past week in Iowa, who really knows? You know, in the past, you had the Iowa straw poll, which sort of had limited the number of candidates. If you had done poorly in that contest and you were supposed to do well, you might drop out of the race. Tim Pawlenty in 2011 comes to mind. Tommy Thompson in 2007 comes to mind. But for what this actually means for the campaign, I don't really think it means very much of anything. I think it's interesting to see, you know, some of the candidates who got larger crowds than others. You know, and some people's speeches were better received than others. But in terms of the long-term effects, I think it's just something, it's just good summer fun and a way to drive up your cholesterol level.
Is it also a chance to get out there and appear one of the people to get your folksiness out there?
I mean, sure, you know, oh, I'm going to go eat a corn dog, or oh, I'm going to eat, you know, something deep fried inside of something else deep fried. I mean, yeah, I mean, but these are politicians. Most of these people are relatively well off. You know, I don't think that people are necessarily fooled, but it's just a good chance for politicians to get their names out in the news, presidential candidates to get their names out in the news, and for voters to see them up close and to say, you know, this is the reason why Iowa's the first in the nation. We get to touch them, get to hear them. It's a nice thing for Iowa. It's a nice thing for the candidates, but its long-term effects, not very much, in my opinion.
Let's talk about Hillary Clinton for a bit. There's been some frustration among her allies, it sounds like, over the way that she seems to be handling concerns and questions over her private email server. And one question is, I mean, this story has lingered for weeks. It broke weeks and weeks ago, and it's still lingering. Has she mishandled it? Did it have to linger for this long?
You know, I think that there's going to be a critic for every occasion. You know, if this were the 2008 Hillary Clinton campaign, they would have been smashing it. They would have been bashing the media. They would have been out in front. You know, there would have been a lot of drama. There would have been a lot of action. And then this time around, you see the exact opposite. There's not a lot of drama. There's not a lot of action. It sounds a lot more like, say, no drama Obama of 2007, 2008. Remember, Obama actually won the primary and became the nominee and eventual president. So, you know, I don't know if there's necessarily a correct way to handle these types of things. What I can say is that, sure, there are some people that, you know, believe she's not handling this correctly. But keep in mind that Hillary Clinton is still well ahead of her pace, you know, in the Iowa caucus. She's, you know, polling near 50%. There was a CNN poll last week that had her right about that level. She was only polling about half that percentage in 2007 at this particular point in time. She's well ahead of her pace there. She's ahead of her pace now. She's ahead of her pace pretty much everywhere, except for maybe New Hampshire. But even there, she's still a few points ahead if you take an average of the polls. So she's doing pretty well. It's not that she's doing terribly. She's doing worse than perhaps she was a few months ago, but she's still in a good position. And that's why I think you're seeing that this no drama, as the campaign ramps up and the other candidates start to get attention. Remember, the reason that a lot of that Clinton's doing poorly is she has all this media focus on her. Once the media starts looking at other people, say Bernie Sanders, who actually never, you know, was a Democratic nominee for Senator for the House, or at least not as his main party, the problems of other candidates will come out.
And just briefly, Harry, as we get ready to wrap up here, Senator Bob Menendez coming out against the Obama administration's nuclear deal with Iran. The Republicans are getting closer in the Senate than to their goal. How do you weigh this one?
I mean, this isn't hugely surprising. I mean, Menendez has for months been saying that he would potentially be against this deal. And, you know, a lot of this opposition is coming from, Democratic opposition is coming from the New York, New Jersey region, which has a lot of Jewish American voters. But just today, Joe Donnelly, who is a very moderate Democrat from the state of Indiana, Democratic senator, came out for the deal. So to me, you know, even there are a bunch of people who are coming out against it. You get guys like Donnelly or Steve Cohn from Tennessee, who was thought of being a swing voter among the Democrats, coming out for the deal. I just don't see how it's going to get derailed.
Well, Harry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time for the latest in national politics.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The campaign to raise minimum wages to $15 an hour has seen success in big coastal cities like New York, Seattle, and Los Angeles. And the push has come to Wisconsin, too. In April, Democratic State Representative Melissa Sargent introduced a bill that would raise the state's minimum wage to $15 by the year 2020.
Yesterday, former Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold voiced support for a $15 federal minimum wage in his first policy speech of his campaign to win back his seat from Senator Ron Johnson. Now, while the increase has seen success in big coastal cities, what would that kind of increase mean for Wisconsin's economy?
Wages and the cost of living in Wisconsin are significantly lower than the places that have chosen to make that jump to $15 an hour. And a $15 minimum wage here would likely have a different impact on the economy than it would in maybe San Francisco, a place that already had a minimum wage of $10.74 an hour.
Here with us to do the economics of a $15 minimum wage in Wisconsin is Stephen Deller. He's a professor of applied economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me back.
Now, before we really dig into this, what's the deal? Why do we have a minimum wage in the first place? Why does that exist?
Well, there's a couple of reasons for it. One is to essentially say that there's something wrong with the labor market. One way to think about it is Adam Smith's invisible hand dropped the ball, and the wages that are being offered are not really reflective of the value of what the workers are actually performing. So there's a role for government to step in and to essentially try to correct that market failure. And that's essentially creating a floor that prices can't really fall below.
Now, there's a federal minimum wage, and then also some states have different minimum wages.
That's right. The federal kind of establishes the bare minimum, and then states can actually go above that, and municipalities can go above that in some states.
Has it always been that way?
It's always been that way.
Okay. So what impact can a minimum wage have on an economy by raising or lowering it?
Well, in the introductory comments, the question about cost of living really comes into play very, very much. You can almost think about it in terms of what is a living wage. In places like San Francisco and New York City and Los Angeles, the cost of living is extremely high. And living on a minimum wage, a federal minimum wage, is below the poverty level.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, if you're working in an environment like that and, you know, you're actually eligible for SNAP programs or food stamps and other types of programs, that's essentially saying something's wrong. But when you get into places like the Midwest and Wisconsin and rural parts of Wisconsin, the cost of living isn't nearly that high. So the question is whether or not you can actually have a decent living on the existing minimum wage. Now, a lot of the research that's out there on cost of living and living wages suggests that the federal minimum wage, is not sufficient. It's too low.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot raise a family or even support a single person household on a minimum wage type of job. It simply is not possible. Now the question becomes, do you go up to $15?
Yeah. I mean, has this always been the case? Has the minimum wage always been like that? Or was there a time when it actually did pay enough for somebody to live a life and be able to pay their expenses?
There was. When the minimum wage was first introduced, it was actually sufficiently high that people could have a decent living. I mean, you're not living the lap of luxury by any means. You're barely scraping by. But there was a time when the minimum wage, but it's inflation has essentially eaten that away. The cost of living has eaten that away. And right now, it's if you're working minimum wage and you're working 40 hours a week, by the time they take out income taxes and different types of taxes and whatnot, you're below the poverty level.
So how does the federal minimum wage compare with state, or I guess municipalities can have minimum wages too? So Madison could set their own minimum wage, right?
Yes, they could, if the state allowed them to.
Right. So how does it differ from place to place?
The best way to think about cost of living is really to think about housing prices. You know, when you think about what is your single biggest out-of-pocket expense, it is primarily your house.
Right.
And if you look at rents, and you say, well, what's a one-bedroom apartment? What's the median one-bedroom apartment? You see significant variations across Wisconsin. Some of the Milwaukee suburbs, to get a decent one-bedroom apartment, you're looking at $900 a month, maybe $1,000 a month. You go into some of the more rural areas, you can get a very nice place for less than $500 a month. So a minimum wage in those more rural areas is going to have a very different effect than in those higher cost of living areas.
No, it would have an effect in both directions, too. I mean, the people who are making it might be able to live pretty well. But then there also is a business side to that, too.
And that's the other side of things is, if we do raise the minimum wage, if we decide as a society that Adam Smith's invisible hand has dropped the ball and that we need to step in and raise the minimum wage to some level, say $15 an hour for a point of discussion, what is that going to do to businesses? Larger businesses that are more profitable can probably absorb that. I think that a lot of more marginal businesses are actually, that's not going to work for them. I think you will actually see a number of smaller businesses essentially say, we can't afford that. So what you'll see is businesses starting to use different alternative strategies. Rather than hiring people and paying them a salary or an hourly wage, what they may do is say, well, what we're going to do is you're going to be a contract worker now.
Mm-hmm.
You see that in the construction industry, for example.
No, so that's the way to get around the minimum wage.
That's the way they get around it, is if you're a general contractor, you could have your own crew, and you're paying them a salary or a wage, an hourly wage, and then the minimum wage would kick in. What you could then do is say, well, we're not going to do that anymore. What we're going to do is that you are now an independent contractor, and we're going to contract with you, and you simply skate around it. You're actually seeing a lot of large corporations starting to do that, not to get around the minimum wage. They're doing it to get around benefits costs, healthcare costs, things like that.
But there could be a way that large corporations deal with the minimum wage too, because I mean, you look at a lot of states, and retail is a big part of the economy. So, you know, would you see more self-service lines at you know, Walmarts and stuff like that?
You will see firms starting to shift. What economists will say is they'll shift away from labor and they'll shift to capital. And what that means is that you'll see more self-checkout lines. You will see things like in warehouses. Rather than having people driving forklift trucks around, you'll actually see these robotic technologies machines coming in, and essentially replacing that labor.
We will finally be replaced by machines.
Which, in theory, makes more leisure time for us. But I don't think it works that way.
We're not making any money.
We're not making any money. Right. Yeah, exactly.
Now, where did the push for the $15 minimum wage thing come in? Is it catchy? So everybody's going after the $15? Was there a reason why $15 was the magic number that people were going after? Or?
It's a nice even round number. I also think that there was a justification a while back that if you look at the old minimum wage thresholds and you kind of adjust for inflation, you're pushing up towards $15 an hour, and I think they picked 15 just because it's a nice round even number.
And what is the federal minimum wage right now?
Oh, I was afraid you were going to ask me that.
Oh, sorry about that.
I don't know right off the top of my head. Maybe a caller does.
I'm sure it's hanging up in the office somewhere.
It is up there.
It's one of those things that you have to show people. Well, we're talking about the economics of a $15 minimum wage in Wisconsin with Stephen Deller. He's a professor of applied economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison here on Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. And with a lower cost of living than the coastal cities that have made the jump, would it have a different effect on the economy here in Wisconsin?
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think that a $15 minimum wage is right for Wisconsin? If you make minimum wage or have in your life, what is the case for it? If you own a company that pays minimum wage, how would it affect you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with Stephen Deller, professor of applied economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're talking about what a $15 minimum wage would mean for Wisconsin's economy. With a lower cost of living than big coastal cities that have already made that jump, what effect would it have here in Wisconsin?
And we'd really like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is $15 too high, too low, or just right for Wisconsin with a different cost of living than places like New York and San Francisco? Do you think it makes sense for the minimum wage to be lower here? If you make minimum wage or if you own a company that pays minimum wage, we'd like to hear your perspective too. Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll just go to the phones right now. Rachel from Milwaukee, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. I have a question about all of us who make $15 an hour. How is that going to pan out for everyone else? So the minimum wage then jumps to 15. Will everyone else's wage get an additional amount added on in order to make it fair? And I'll take my answer off the phone. Thank you.
Okay, Rachel, thanks for that call. And I'm guessing that other wages will not go up.
No, they won't. And that's, Rachel, that's one of the concerns with this kind of a large bump. If you're working in an industry where the typical worker is making, say, $10, $11, $12, and your position is such that you're making more than that, what you'll see is all those lower wage workers come up to that $15, what you're making. Now, the question is that going to create resentment within the workplace? And
Is there any indication that that happens? I mean, has there been any research done on that?
Not that I'm aware of, but we're talking about such a big jump. Well, it's be phased in over time, but that's one of the concerns, is that it could create resentment, and that's a very real possibility.
We're talking about a $15 minimum wage with Stephen Deller on Central Time. Let's go back to the phones. Joe in Green Bay, welcome to Central Time.
Greetings. Thanks for having me on. Greatly appreciate it. The minimum wage really doesn't factor in how it affects business owners, those that have to make the decision. So I'm wondering, since their comments aren't really included, why not make it $25 an hour? Because that would be even more effective for workers.
It depends on why we're doing this. If the reason that we're doing it is because we think the labor market is there's something broken with the labor market, again, Adam Smith's invisible hand has dropped the ball, then, there's a role for government to step in. If we're doing it because it's an equity argument, that, we just don't think that this is fair. As a society, we want people to make better wages, or we want in our community jobs that are better paying, then we go down a different route. But I think you're right, though. I mean, one of the arguments or one of the things we have to worry about is how are businesses, particularly in Wisconsin, going to be able to adapt to this and adjust to this?
Now, Joe's comment about how businesses aren't really factored into the equation when people talk about minimum wage, is that true, or are there some businesses that believe that it should be raised?
There are businesses that think it should be raised. They're already doing that. There are a lot of businesses that pay above the minimum wage. They're paying above what the prevailing wage is in the local community. And they're doing that because they think that, they're investing in their workers. There was the example of the one credit card company out in Seattle, I believe it was, that raised everybody's salary up to $70,000. The argument is that if I pay my workers good money and I offer decent benefits, I'm going to have more productive workers. And a lot of businesses are already doing that.
And there have been some follow-up stories to that that suggest that that's not working as well as they were hoping, though, too, right?
Well, there was some resentment within the business that upper management was now suddenly making the same as the support staff. There's a little bit of resentment there. And it's not as... The transition has not been as smooth as everybody had hoped it would be.
Well, we're talking about a $15 minimum wage on Central Time, and you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Ellen from Big Bend, you're on the air now. Ellen, welcome to Central Time. What's your comment?
I find this disturbing. If we introduce a $15 minimum wage, maybe especially here in Wisconsin, people that are earning $15 and $18 an hour currently are going to demand an increase in their pay. And the people that are making $25 an hour are going to demand an increase in their pay. If you don't speak English, you don't graduate from high school, you don't get any continuation in education or develop marketable skills, you don't get to make $15 an hour. And that's not rocket science.
That is a perfectly legitimate argument. I mean, a cold-hearted economist essentially says that people are paid the value of their work. What is their productivity? What is the value of the good or service that they're making? And people that are, say, less educated, that are less motivated to work, their productivity is lower, and pay should reflect that. The question is if businesses are taking advantage of that. And that's where the market failure comes into play. You can get into some rural communities where you have a handful of very large businesses, and they basically dominate. They set the stage for what wages will be. And that's a market failure. Your question, though, about, if wages get pushed up, will people that are a little bit above that start to demand higher wages? And two things. One is, ideally, we would like to see better-paying jobs in Wisconsin. I think that that's one of the things that a lot of communities are very concerned about, is they've kind of moved away from a job as a job, and they're thinking, we want better jobs in our community. We want jobs where people can advance. We want jobs where people can support a family. So on the one hand, good, push those wages up. The question, though, is that if they're artificially pushed up, will that just kind of feed inflation? And that is a very legitimate question. The research has suggested that at the national level, that has not occurred. But we haven't been talking about this big of an increase before. This is a pretty big increase.
All right. Well, let's keep on going to the phones. Lots of people calling in. Thanks for that call, Alan. We appreciate it. Chris from Madison, welcome to Central Time.
Yes. Great topic. I want to get your guest's comment on the research that every time the minimum wage has been raised, it actually negatively impacts the people at the lowest rung of the totem pole. For instance, every single time the minimum wage has been raised, minority unemployment rates have gone up.
There is a short-term shock to that. The question is, what happens over the longer term? And the research suggests that over the longer term, businesses do adapt, the labor market does adapt, and those unemployment rates come back down again. So the question is that, are we willing to accept a short-term shock to the system where some businesses are going to simply say, we can't afford this anymore, we're going to go under. Some folks, particularly the lower educated, the folks with less experience, less skills, probably those that are not as motivated to work, they will be negatively affected. But over the long term, the research has suggested that the market comes back and people are actually a little bit better off after that increase has occurred.
But it also shows just how complicated economics can be.
Yeah, it's, what's the short term? What's the long term? I mean, are we talking a one-year adjustment? Are we talking a two-year adjustment? And that's why I think they're talking about phasing in this increase. I think if they went from the current minimum wage to $15 an hour overnight, it would be a real shock to the economy that would not be good.
All right. Well, let's go to Gail in Eagle River. Gail, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm from Eagle River, Wisconsin, and I don't have a question. I just had a comment. You wanted to know how it would affect up here or the different places in Wisconsin. And up here in Eagle River, a lot of us are paying more than the minimum wage to get good employees. But if we had to do $15 an hour for all our employees, I think a lot of businesses would be hurt. I know mine would.
And how big is your business, Gail? How many people?
It's a small office in our supply store, and I have two employees, and then my husband and I also put in some time there as well.
Well, thanks for that comment, Gail. So what's your reaction to that?
I think that's the concern. And this is something that I think we as a society have to talk about, is do we want jobs in our community that are paying below a certain level? And in a cold, you know, we could simply say as a community, well, we appreciate that you're paying more than minimum wage, but we want better paying jobs in our community. And that's something that we have to talk about and decide what we want as a society.
Well, I'm sure we'll continue this conversation in the weeks and months to come. Thanks so much for talking to us, Stephen.
It's been a pleasure.
Stephen Deller is professor of applied economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he was talking to us about what a $15 minimum wage would mean for Wisconsin's economy. You can continue the conversation at the Central Time Facebook page. When there's a weird new food up for grabs, chances are you'll find it first at a state fair. The Iowa State Fair offered people something new this year. Super cold beer served at 27 degrees. That's below freezing.
That's right. This is the idea, a brainchild, if you will, of a man from Altoona who runs a company called Stierenstein. He spent a lot of time, months, perfecting this process. What happens is the beer gets cooled in a bath, mixing cold air and water, and the whole contraption supposedly looks like a cold beer jacuzzi.
And the deal is the beer gets served to hot fairgoers, and they're supposed to drink it right out of the cooler. No mug required. In fact, the mug makes it taste kind of bad, apparently, if you put it into a mug.
So there's been a bit of debate about this on the Central Time team. I'm not a beer drinker, but those who are say beer supposedly tastes a little better when it's a little warmer. I don't know, Mike, where do you weigh in on this?
Well, you know, maybe this beer tastes better cold. I mean, there are a lot of people who like a cold beer.
Well,
right?
These are domestics. This is something like Budweiser and Miller Lite.
I would think it actually would contribute to fewer bad things happening at the state fair, because people, you can't really slam a beer that's below freezing. I mean, you just have serious brain freeze. So in some ways, it's contributing to the responsibility of fairgoers. I think it's actually a good thing.
Could be refreshing. All right, well, let us know if you tried this beer. Does it give you the brain freeze? Slow you down a little? Let us know on the Central Time Facebook page.